Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. This is a great topic this morning. So let me first introduce to you our moderator, who is an expert in her field and well-received at Syracuse University for that. This is Dessa Bergen-Seco, PhD, and she's an associate professor in the Department of Public Health and teaches in the Addiction Studies, Trauma Studies, and Neuroscience programs at Syracuse University. She holds a research appointment at the Syracuse Veterans Administration Medical Center, is a Fulbright Scholar, Fellow of the American Academy of Healthcare Providers in the Addictive Disorders, and Certified Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Teacher. Her areas of teaching and research focus on alcohol and other drugs, addictive behaviors, and other matters related to public health. Dr. Bergen-Seco has been working and conducting research with diverse populations and cultures for over 20 years. She is the author of over 30 scholarly publications, including the book War and Drugs, The Role of Military Conflict in the Development of Substance Abuse. Erin Bortel earned a bachelor's degree in social work from Syracuse University and a master's degree from the University of Kansas, where she focused her studies on nonprofit management and policy studies. She serves as the Director of Prevention Services at ARC Health. Erin oversees 14 prevention programs in 12 upstate New York counties. She provides oversight to the Syringe Exchange Program, the Safety First Medical Clinic, and the Opioid Overdose Prevention Service. Mark Raymond is the manager of Krauss Hospital's Opioid Treatment Program. He earned a master's degree in counseling and human services and has been employed by Krauss for more than 20 years. Mark serves on the board of the New York State Coalition of Medication-Assisted Treatment Providers and Advocates. Finally, we have Michelle Kaliva, RN. Is the administrative director of the Upstate New York Poison Center, a position she has held since 2003. Michelle is a frequent invited guest lecturer on topics related to toxicology and drugs of abuse. She was the past president of the New York State Public Health Association and is currently on their board. She also serves as a member of the American Public Health Association. She has a nursing degree from St. Joseph's College of Nursing, a Bachelor's of Science degree from SUNY Empire Health Care, and a Master's degree in Homeland Security from the Naval Postgraduate School. Please join me in welcoming our moderator and our panel.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to start with a few statistics and points, and then engage the panel in their thoughts and reflections. One thing is, we look at the issue around heroin and opioid overdose deaths, that in the U.S. we're averaging about 129 deaths per day. So putting that into perspective and looking at what's been happening here in our own community, it's a shift in how we've often looked at and approached the issues of drugs and addiction. The people have been suffering with this for a long time, and now it has spread into different demographics, and we're looking at it in a, often the people who make policies, in a more personal facet. About 10% of the adult population fits under the category, if we look at in terms of addiction, not just to heroin, but also things like alcohol and other substances. And there's about an additional 40 million adults that struggle with substance abuse, perhaps not addiction. So it touches all of our lives in many different ways. And so from that perspective, if we can keep in mind as we start to examine how do we address this issue, traditionally sort of the American perspective has been focused somewhat on punishment and distancing ourselves from people who are using substances. And if we can agree that the ultimate objective of whatever the policies are that we're trying to do is to decrease suffering and to minimize the risks to the individual and to the community at large. And then we back up from there and we look at some new approaches and new ways for how we might develop policies, programs, and services to shift the tide that we're currently in with the opioid and heroin epidemic. And so my colleagues here on the panel are on the front lines of dealing with these issues. From the Poison Control Center, before statistics are nationally known, they're dealing with calls that are coming in for things like fentanyl-laced heroin and overdose. Certainly the treatment centers have a much more nuanced insight as to what's happening with folks. And they were, if I'm not mistaken, I think in the early 90s, one of the first places in upstate New York, only places that had opioid substitution with methadone. And then also from from ACR, I was delighted to learn a few years ago that we had somewhat on the down low, but a very successful syringe exchange program. One of the things that's important to look at here is that the opportunity to stay connected with people that are using is first and foremost, because when we shut people out, we lose the ability to have a positive influence on them. And so that being said, I would turn the questions over to the panel to open up and ask about what new and innovative policies and approaches of promising practices are you aware of that you would like to see us try here in Onondaga County?
Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation today. So ACR Health has the vision of building a community where every person has the right and the opportunity to achieve optimal health and equality. And this is really difficult to do, especially when you're in the throes of addiction. My world centers on interfacing with people with addictions on a daily basis. Our syringe exchange program opened in December of 2011 after 16 years of community advocacy. And quite frankly, there's still certain areas of our community where we're not welcome or allowed to operate because of certain political pressures that we face. As of yesterday, when I checked our enrollment, we have over 2,200 people coming to us to receive clean needles. And I was reflecting this morning with some associates, I don't think that even we were prepared for that in the volume and the growth that we experienced in that particular service. We're one of the fastest growing syringe exchange programs in New York State. There's only a handful of us, and we're very lucky to operate in New York State, but there's only about 25 syringe exchange programs that operate in all of New York State. ACR Health covers about 12,000 square miles, which is 9 upstate counties. We have 2 offices that deliver these services, and we also deliver the syringe exchange program through a mobile health unit, which operates on the near west side of the city of Syracuse. From our experience with syringe exchange, we very quickly realized that our first and foremost goal is to save lives, and that we can't hope to do that if people are disconnected. So I really appreciate that reflection. So about 2.5 years ago, we opened up our opiate overdose prevention service, or Narcan is the common name for it, or Naloxone is the generic version. And in this program, we're allowed to, under sanctions from a clinical director, a doctor, as well as the State Department of Health, train regular people like you and I in how to recognize the signs of an opiate overdose and intervene with the drug, naloxone, if they need to. Since that program started, again, only 2 years ago, we've distributed more than 2,000 rescue kits and have more than 45 lives saved, that's reported to us at least. Ironically, this week, we're wrapping up the first year of service in our new medical clinic, which was also funded by the State Department of Health and was built to target injection drug users, knowing that the lifestyle of injection drug use and decisions that people who are in, again, the throes of addiction make don't always lead to positive health outcomes. So we built a medical facility which is an exam room in our current office space, which is adjacent to our syringe exchange program. And with very little trouble and not much effort at all, anyone who comes into our syringe exchange program who has some type of acute medical need, such as an abscess on their arm or other respiratory issues or anything really that they need addressing, they can see a nurse practitioner either at no cost or if they have insurance, we can bill their insurance program. Because of that medical outreach, we are now prescribing Suboxone and Vivitrol on site. And as a 30-year agency, this is the first time that we've been able to dip our toes into providing that actual direct treatment to people who are using drugs. And the service is meant to bridge into a more permanent treatment location. And that's done only by our medical director, not our nurse practitioner. I want to touch on just a couple of other things very briefly. A lot of our work centers around engaging people who are completely disconnected from the system. So we are seeing folks who may have called poison control but haven't even thought about treatment yet. And I consider our services, again, that bridge to care. So because they come in and they receive positive reinforcement, they're treated with dignity, respect, compassion, they're able to establish a trusting relationship with us. And then they buy into the idea of treatment a little bit more successfully as if they were to try, you know, going at it on their own. And we're able to kind of move them along that spectrum until they understand that it's their choice, that they're ready for it, and that it's the right thing to do. And we hope that all of our clients do move in that direction. That involves a lot of outreach on the streets, again, through our mobile health units. We do a lot of forums like this that are community-focused. We're on social media pushing messages out to educate people about the services and create safe opportunities for them to reach out to us and disclose that they need assistance. In terms of some alternative strategies, I'm really happy that's the first question because I think that we're dealing with a radical problem and we need to really think about some radical solutions. So I would contend that syringe exchange is part of the treatment spectrum and that it might be the first point that someone has, again, a conversation about treatment as an opportunity to changing their life. As I alluded to earlier, my personal mission is to preserve life first, and because that gives other professionals the opportunity to intervene with treatment. So in the effort of preserving life, I think we really need to consider some alternative strategies, particularly supervised injection facilities, which I know are a very controversial topic right now. They're also called drug consumption rooms. And the idea is that people who are using actively have a safe place to do so, and they're being supervised by medical professionals. So there's a program that operates only one in North America, in Vancouver, Canada, who's had services for about 10 years. They've supervised 1 million injections at this point, and they have not had a single fatality. So if we can move towards an understanding that these services act as that gateway into everything else that we want people to do, then you can be a little bit more open-minded to understand how this works. And this isn't a new idea. This has been happening for about 40 years or so in places across the world, namely Europe and Australia also has a program. So I think that that's a very practical suggestion. There's some other things that need to happen in terms of policy, increasing access to medication-assisted therapies, and we've made some progress in that locally in the past year or so. But really, the other thing that has to happen is this, which is the community dialogue, and we have to continue talking about this, which will help address the shame and stigma that people who experience addictions live with on a day-to-day basis. Personal disclosure, about a month and a half ago, our agency lost a coworker to a drug overdose, and it was eye-opening in that even within our very safe, comfortable world of harm reduction, that shame and stigma exist, and that person did not feel comfortable enough in reaching out for help. And at this point, we're too late in helping him and his family. But we can continue this mission of trying to instill a safe space in our community so that people who are living with this on a day-to-day basis aren't worried that they're going to lose their jobs, aren't worried that they're going to lose friends or that they'll be criticized by family members and shamed. So I leave you with that. And again, I thank you for the invitation and your time this morning.
So to answer your question, as far as what radical, you know, what new techniques that we can use, I know that I'm going to, first of all, be probably repeating some of the things that you said, but these forums are excellent, bringing an awareness to everyone, because this is affecting all walks of life, and so this is one thing. I know that changes are also happening at the legislative level. Laws have changed in terms of prescription monitoring, how often people, you know, how long a prescription is given to people. And that's really important to think about, because I also know there's been shifts in law enforcement.
Are you referring in terms of like the potential gateway for addiction? So if you're prescribed like OxyContin, that there's a shorter...
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, so there's just opiates are a great medication for pain management. And pain management can be, it's crucial. Pain can be, really hard for people to cope with. But the truth is this heroin epidemic, and I really appreciate the fact that you had said heroin and opiate. Now that we're calling it a heroin epidemic, I think we want to be careful with that, because this epidemic started with a prescription drug epidemic. We had, 10 years, 15 years of this being noticing an increase in prescribed opiates, mm-hmm. and then noticing an increase in fatal overdoses, which brought a lot of attention to this topic. And then as we started implementing strategies to limit the number of prescribed opiates on the streets, people from all walks of life started turning to heroin. And now it's not just heroin, it's also fentanyl. So we need to keep in mind that this is an opioid epidemic, and heroin is part of that. And I don't want to get into, you talked about stigma. You know, when we start talking about it being a heroin epidemic, that may allow people to kind of step back and start thinking this doesn't apply to all of those people that are being prescribed opiates. Many of the people that are seeking treatment today started with a prescribed opiate. Mm-hmm. And many of those people had legitimate medical conditions. Opiates, why? They feel good. They alleviate pain. People who use opiates, they may serve a wonderful purpose, but they're at risk of dependency and addiction. Mm-hmm. So that's how we've come to this heroin epidemic, and I think it's important to keep that in mind. And how did we get here? Well, I just kind of spoke about how we got here. People develop a high level of tolerance for opiates, and people experience withdrawal once they become dependent on opiates. And withdrawal can be acute, and there's also post-acute withdrawal. So there's a very high relapse rate amongst people who are addicted to opiates, because for them, opiate withdrawal is like the flu times 10. It's debilitating. They don't feel like they can function without putting another opiate in their body. And then in comes fentanyl. Fentanyl is estimated to be 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin. And people talk about heroin being a cheaper alternative, or now fentanyl being a cheaper alternative. Well, if somebody has a high tolerance to opiates, they're going to need more opiates to either meet that tolerance and function or exceed that tolerance. Well, now with fentanyl being on the street, we once thought that people were only using fentanyl on accident. It was laced in their heroin. Well, if you're an opiate-dependent person and 10 bags of heroin still isn't enough, well, guess what? I'm going to go to fentanyl. I'm going to look for fentanyl, because that's going to help me meet the tolerance and alleviate the withdrawal, maybe even at a cheaper price. And that's a fatal attraction. So, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about what we do too. Once somebody's addicted to opiates, it's considered a lifelong condition. The Diagnostical Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, it's opioid substance use disorder. It's a medical condition. And once somebody has it, they really need to be aware of it for the rest of their life. In terms of treatment, yes, people can do it without medication-assisted therapy. It's possible. But unfortunately, the statistics of success for somebody who's not using medication-assisted therapy are low. And also, not using medication-assisted therapy, if somebody does well for a while, it could be a high risk factor for overdose, because a period of abstinence is actually one of the most dangerous factors for a fatal overdose, because their tolerance goes down, and then when they return to use, it exceeds their tolerance and they overdose and pass away. And there's far too many of them happening now. And it's not just the people that die, it's those loved ones who are affected by it. But as far as medication-assisted therapy, that's also, it's not new. However, there's new things being added, like Vivitrol. But what is really cool is that more attention and more respect is being paid to medication-assisted therapy. It's becoming less controversial. And that's huge, because medication-assisted therapy, along with wraparound services, which is extremely important, can lead to very high success rates for patients who are dealing with substance use disorder, opioid substance use disorder. There's three types of medication right now that are used for medication-assisted therapy. Each of them has some unique qualities, but all three of them serve as, they have some similar qualities too, and they offer an opportunity to block the receptors, block the effects of other opiates, and they also can help relieve cravings and withdrawal syndrome, and that allows the person to function. These medications taken properly, without other drugs, and at correct medication doses, the person is not experiencing being high. They're not intoxicated. It would be really helpful if people can understand that a person taking this medication correctly it's a medication, not a drug replacing a drug. Each also has some unique qualities. Methadone is a medication that's been studied since the 1960s, Dolan-Niswander, consensus studies, and it's been proven to be very effective in treating opioid dependency. Methadone currently can only, for addiction, can only be prescribed within the confines of an opioid treatment program. There's Suboxone. Suboxone is another great medication that can be prescribed either in an OTP or in the privacy of a physician's office. And then there's also Vivitrol, which is the newest of the medications, and that's a once a month injection that can be prescribed either within a treatment program or a doctor's office. I think, you know, just to talk a little bit about Kraus, and I appreciate that you mentioned for a while we were the only program. Kraus has actually supported treating the opioid substance use disorder population since the 1970s. And during this recent epidemic, not only have they supported our department, the leadership of Kraus, not only have they supported our department, but they've expected our department to expand its services and try to meet the needs of the community. Just since 2013, we admitted 157 patients to our program. This year, we're on target to admit over 320 patients to our program. And that's a huge jump. We've expanded our staff. We've expanded. We've remodeled. We've done things to increase our medication windows, all in an attempt to meet this. And it still hasn't been enough. So thank goodness, just recently, Conifer Park also opened up a program in Liverpool. They opened up in April. And Credo up in Watertown opened up a program, just started medicating, I think, September 21st, or maybe a week ago, today. And that's great. And there's also programs that are looking to open up in Oswego, Utica, Rome, and another program maybe here in Syracuse. And you say, well, those other locations, why is that important? Well, currently, we're supposed to reach 700 patients today. And about 70% of those patients come from Onondaga County. And about 30% of those patients are coming from surrounding counties. So if we can get programs in all of these counties and some of these outside counties, that can definitely help. And patients traveling all the way from Watertown or Utica for the treatment, and if you come to our program, you need to start 7 days per week because we want to make sure that you're safe. And so it's an honor to be part of Kraus as they completely support us moving along. It's important to understand this is not just about medication, though. A key concept for a patient receiving medication is these wraparound services. And all the programs should have this, but I'll speak for Kraus. You know, we have a team of 18 counselors, 9, 10 nurses, support staff, treatment aides, and leadership, and it's meant to meet all of the needs. Addiction affects all areas of the patient's life, medical, mental health, spiritual, social. So it's very important that we address all of those areas of one's life, too, in treatment. It's not just about medication. And if all of those areas are addressed in somebody's life, that's going to give them the best chance to a successful recovery. And I'll leave you with that there was a recent article in the newspaper, Syracuse.com, that said we had something like 30 deaths in our county alone as of June 1st, I think it was. And that's far too many, obviously. You know, overdoses are passing if they haven't already. Motor vehicle accidents is the number one cause of accidental death. Well, it could happen any day, so I don't want this to happen. But we have 700 patients, and to this year, we've had no deaths by overdose. Why? Because treatment works. And I don't want to advocate for one particular treatment or one particular program, but I do want to advocate for treatment, and I want people to help their loved ones get into treatment, support their loved ones in getting treatment, and consider all of the options that are out there and find the best one, know the benefits and the risks of each one, and find the right one for the person and then support them through that. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. Michelle?
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you today, but thank you even more for caring enough about this topic to be here. As Mark said, the fact that we're all coming together for these community forums, I think speaks volumes. We weren't doing this 5 years ago, so I really appreciate you all being here. I have to wonder if some of you are surprised that someone from Poison Control is talking about drugs of abuse. I think the typical image that most people at least verbalize to me when they think about poison center is they think of a small child that's at home that gets into shampoo or a cleaning product. But actually, we've been dealing with drugs of abuse and overdoses and suicide attempts using drugs for forever. The poison center has been in Onondaga County I haven't worked there this long, but for over 50 years. Close, but not quite. Just to give you some perspective, we cover 54 counties in New York State. We do not cover New York City, Long Island, or Westchester, but we cover the rest of the state. And the reason why I bring that up is just to tell you it's obviously not a problem in Onondaga County, clearly. What I think is even more important to know is that this is not a problem in the suburbs, it's not a problem in the urban areas, it's not a problem in rural New York State, it's across the board. It doesn't matter where I go. I travel through the state and do these educational programs for healthcare providers, as does my staff, as well as law enforcement and the general public. And it does not matter what area of the state I'm in, it's the same problem. If we look at the trends that the Poison Center has seen, I will tell you, again, as Mark has mentioned, there's been a steady increase in call volume around opioids for a very, very long time. Do you remember the synthetic and the bath salts from 2012? And everybody was concerned, and we kept getting invited to come and talk about those topics, which were important and vital. But every time I would do a presentation on the synthetic marijuana or the synthetic bath salts, I would say, let's not forget about heroin. Let's not forget about oxycodone. Let's not forget. I mean, I always felt compelled because we were watching those trends. I see it from an acute perspective. So I'm not sure if everybody knows quite how we work, but somebody calls the Poison Center either from the home or from a healthcare facility. And we have 125 healthcare facilities that call us. They don't call us daily, but they call us pretty consistently. When we get calls from the healthcare facility, those are the ones that we're tracking. So when I get asked for data on heroin or opioid abuse, it's those calls that come from healthcare facilities. They are the sick patients. They are the acutely ill patients. They're the patients that we hear about that have died. That has increased steadily. So just for giving an example, in 2014, we had 355 acutely ill patients from across the state. That bounced up to just under 400 in 2015. And we're over 555 cases right now, and we still have how many months to go until the end of the year? That, to me, is staggering. So what we do, and asking about what innovative things that we do, what we do is we go out and do programs for healthcare providers, which we've always done, but now we're reaching out to college campuses. And I've learned a lot from college campuses. I will tell you, they're my favorite because I really learn what's going on. We talk to healthcare providers there, but as well as RAs, as well as students. We also go out and again and talk to the general public, but I will tell you where we don't get invited and where we really could use some help. We don't get invited to come and talk to parents and to high schools. Now, our prevention folks, our colleagues, are doing a great job in the schools with the students. But in a lot of the areas, we say, we'd love to talk to parents. We don't get invited. Sometimes it's because school superintendents don't want us invited, or principals, because of the stigma associated with having a conversation around drugs of abuse in their schools. Sometimes, I actually got disinvited by a parent once. I was supposed to go to a suburban high school in our area, and a parent called and said, Ooh, you know what? We changed the agenda. Please don't come. The night of that presentation, the principal called and said, where are you? Interestingly enough, when I did finally present to that school, a mom raised her hand and said, that's a very interesting case study you just presented, but that's a Syracuse City School problem. That wouldn't happen here. And I couldn't tell her it was her school. I couldn't tell her, obviously. So we've kind of, for our approach is really four-pronged. So we do public education, we do professional education, we provide case management recommendations to physicians and nurses in the emergency department around managing the heroin and the opioid in the acute phase, right? So my colleagues here are treating the patients. We're trying to save their lives acutely from an overdose. But the other piece that we do is we provide situational awareness. We do surveillance. So right now we're getting the word out to everybody that fentanyl is a problem, but there is a additional synthetic-like fentanyl that's hitting the streets. Whether it's here or not, we're not quite sure, but we know it's across the country.
Is it W18?
Pardon me?
W18?
Yep, and also there's the C...
C18.
Yep, C18. And so we're going to start to push out that via social media, and we'll reach out to our colleagues in the departments of health. We do a blog and get information to say, you may not see it, but it's out there. So that's the other piece of what we do. And really, to be honest with you, I really grabbed my whole team. We have 38 of us at the Poison Center, and we sat down and said, we need to change our focus, and we're in the midst of an epidemic. So while we still talk about poison prevention, we are predominantly talking about drugs of abuse and how we can manage this.
Thank you. And before we turn it over to the audience for some questions and back and forth, and in the absence of our law enforcement representative, I would like to just make a note about some of the aspects when we're looking at changes in how police are interfacing with people with substance abuse and addiction problems. And unfortunately, I'm less aware about what's going on in my own community here. I've been overseas the past year and came back to say I'm less in touch with my own community than I am some other areas. But there are, particularly where they were hard hit in Boston and the greater Boston area, the police officers there have gone through a change of heart, increased awareness, and are now often responding to people who are under the influence or who have overdosed or who may have personal use quantities of drugs on themselves, and shifting it from a moment of arrest and tragedy to an opportunity to motivate the person and to be able to put them into treatment. Where they enter treatment and they go without an arrest record. Because at the end of the day, this is really a health issue. It's a medical issue. There's a distinction between the person who's dealing drugs and the person who's using drugs. And so they are recognizing that and working with that on a different basis. And also responding to the issue in terms of saying, is this a person who's more likely to be a risk to myself and to the community or to hurt themselves, and then to respond appropriately with that. But the law enforcement there have been, in many of these areas, have been key and paramount to getting people into treatment. I do know, having talked to some of the Syracuse Police Department staff, I was very heartened to hear their description of how they're responding to a number of the different issues, and they treat it as a public health issue. On low levels in terms of personal use, and to try to look at how do we appropriately respond to this. And so if we can keep that distinction in mind, I think that's helpful. Would
you like me to comment a little bit about the law enforcement? I do know a little bit about what's going on with law enforcement.
Sure, yeah.
Very quick. I'll just add that, Onondaga County has added Vivitrol within their justice system, which I think is extremely important. That's going to allow people with opioid substance use disorder who are being released about a 30-day window to possibly engage in treatment, because being in jail, period of abstinence, getting released from jail, relapse could really lead to a fatal overdose. So that's one step that's taken place. Our Syracuse Drug Court has always been supportive of medication-assisted therapy, so I think that's fantastic. However, a law was passed that, because unfortunately across the state, not all drug treatment courts have been supportive, and a law was passed to support that. So now there's a law that people can't make a client not engage in medication-assisted therapy. So if somebody's with Child Protective Services, if somebody's committed a crime, they have to consider and recognize that as a valuable treatment option. And I do believe that our law enforcement might be carrying Narcan right now. So I just thought I'd add those three things.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so now I'd like to open it up to questions.
Could you speak to the issue of unrecognized, untreated mental health problems and what the relationship between those types of concerns and addiction as a narrower field?
I think it's a great question. I think it's very important for mental health to be treated. If somebody's feeling depressed anyway, I think that can make recovery and not using drugs a much less attractive option. So if you don't treat the mental health along with the addiction issues, then that person may continue to struggle and not really understand why their recovery is even worth it. I think there's also a shortage in mental health and psychiatry care in our area, so that doesn't help matters very much. And symptoms can also be similar. If somebody's dealing with anxiety, they could think that's withdrawal, or if they're dealing withdrawal, they could think that that's anxiety, and if they're self-medicating, they could self-medicate in a very detrimental way. I think it's a great question. I don't have a great answer. I think we need to keep asking it, and we need to increase services, and when patients come into programs, they should be evaluated for that. They should look for symptoms and address both as quickly and as efficiently as possible.
I would add also that over 50% of people who are in treatment for mental health-related issues also have substance use disorders, and among people in treatment for substance use disorders, about 65-70% also have co-occurring mental health issues. And so you see that there's this circular aspect in terms of how they're co-related to one another, and people are, again, seeking to end their own suffering and finding it perhaps through chemical means unwittingly. And biology takes over, psychology takes over.
If I could add one more point, please. A lot of what we experience as a root cause is a person who's dealing with some type of trauma in their life that has never been appropriately addressed. The trauma was never recognized. Maybe they didn't have a safe place or a safe avenue to try to address that, whether it was childhood or not. And their addiction is a manifestation of a failed coping strategy. So there's a movement in our field right now to approach every single person who walks through your door with the assumption that they've experienced some type of trauma, because it's very likely that that's the case. And if you just make that assumption from the get-go, you can start to come to a place of, again, creating that safety for the patient or participant in the program where they can really get to that root cause in a safe way, and whether that's in an addiction setting or a mental health setting.
Thank you.
Good morning. I've learned a few things this morning from all of you folks. My question really goes to people, this current controversy about legalizing marijuana. And based on what I've heard, a lot of what happens is an outgrowth of normal medications for people with issues, problems. What makes something like marijuana, as people want to say, well, they can use it better for treatment or whatever, as opposed to heroin or any other particular drug, if we start legalizing and allowing people to sell it over the counter or whatever, as opposed to being a prescribed drug per se, where does it end? Where do you stop when you quote legalize it?
That's a good point. And I would say there's a distinction also in terms of there's now that there's been some relaxation of the federal oversight for it, we've been able to do more quality research on what are the actual potential medical benefits for specific conditions with regards to cannabis or marijuana use. And the other thing to note, too, is that marijuana operates very differently, so it has a very low addiction potential. So there's stimulants, depressants, and then all-arounder, so to speak, and cannabis or marijuana is in that other category. So it has less of a what we call tissue dependency, where it, you know, the body is really relying on it, and also has lower psychological dependency. It's also important to note, though, that it can be, that we need to be clear about our distinction between when we're looking at legalization for medical use and legalization for recreational use, because it starts to blur those lines again of recreational use of narcotics and medical use of narcotics. Having said that, there is, because our veterans are teaching us a lot about the potential for appropriate use of many different medications as well as the inappropriate use of it. But with cannabis, there's now evidence that it helps to reduce some of the chronic pain that then enables them to not use the heavy opioids, which are prone towards addiction. So that is one aspect. But it's you raise a great question, because it's very difficult to understand the nuances between the different categories of drugs. And in reality, cannabis or marijuana is a very low addiction potential, but it requires public education and monitoring, not just open the floodgates, so to speak. I don't know if anybody else wants to weigh in on that.
So ACR Health is an advocate of compassionate care and specifically medical marijuana. There are medical conditions that this particular treatment helps significantly improve the quality of life. Just like opiates, though, medical marijuana is not for every single condition that exists. And I think that the general public could perceive that as we move in this direction. So it's interesting, as we're wrapping up really the first year of access of medical marijuana in New York State, and that it's still out of reach for a lot of people. There's still a lot of stigma, even in the clinical community, about prescribing it. So we're having trouble. I think there's two prescribers locally that at least we're aware of that we would direct patients to if it's appropriate. Quickly, because ACR Health is rooted in the HIV and AIDS epidemic, one particular syndrome that comes up frequently, or at least used to, is something called wasting syndrome, where people who are afflicted with AIDS specifically really withered drastically. And their nutrition quality in terms of foods that they were trying to eat, they couldn't eat. There wasn't an appetite. Medication treatments were horrible when the AIDS epidemic started, before there were even treatments. So wasting syndrome is something that is very well addressed by medical marijuana, because it does create that sense of appetite and allows people to gain nutritional value from the foods that they eat. There's other conditions that are also equally benefited from that particular prescription. But
I'd like to make a quick comment, too, if that's okay. So obviously there's great medical efficacy, at least there seems to be some evidence supporting that for use of medical marijuana. It's a controlled setting. But I will just tell you, I just came back from a toxicology symposium in Boston that was held this past month, and there were multiple presentations and case studies on sick patients that were recreationally using marijuana. We hadn't seen that. There are not a lot of case studies, but there were. And what it came from is some of the states where it is being more widely used, and there's definitely work that has to be done. I have great concern about just the opening the gates for the recreational use, because there are some people that may be physically predisposed to some problems, and there were some really, really tragic cases that surprised us all.
Thank you.
Good morning, panel. My observational experience has been that the real concern about drug overdose came about when it hit the suburbs, mm-hmm. and when it became a white man's issue. And so I would like to know, from a clinical standpoint, if the whole community is truly being served, or if indeed the people with good insurance policies are the ones that are being taken care of.
That's a great question.
I'm not in the front lines, but I was on a meeting with Assemblyman Al Sturpee last week. He was trying to look at how do we have better access to care and what's needed. And I do know that from people who take Medicaid, serving people with below the poverty line, that they are struggling to get payment from insurance providers and therefore unable to take in more people. So not everyone is being served. But perhaps Mark can talk more directly about that, being in the treatment field.
I do think it's a great point and a great question. I can say, you know, from Kraus that for a long time, since we've had our patient population has been approximately, you know, low 80% Caucasian, coming from the suburbs, coming from the inner city. So from a treatment perspective, we didn't look at it that way. but it would really be difficult for me to sit here and say that the attention of, you know, middle class Caucasian or others from affluent areas dying of overdoses in the suburbs or on college campuses, or, you know, finally it affecting somebody who professionals love, or didn't help bring attention to this. I'm sure it did. I don't think that was intentional, but I think it's actually helped, even if it's a poor way to get here. As far as availability, we're working on insurance stuff. I know that Kraus will accept people on sliding scale fees. So even if you don't have insurance, we'll work with you. I apologize because I understand this isn't just about Kraus. This is about everybody. But most there's a lot of work going into insurance companies right now. There's a lot of talk. There's a lot of advocating at the state level about including medication-assisted therapy in insurance approvals. So I do believe we're making progress. I think you bring a great question. That's my best answer.
One of the challenges is not the providers themselves. I think that our provider community is doing everything that they can to meet extremely high demand on our service system right now. It actually comes down to the payers and whether, so in this case, insurance companies, and what they're going to reimburse for, how they're going to reimburse.
If they're going to reimburse.
If they're going to reimburse at all, it's going to take 6 months for the provider to receive payment for the service that had already been delivered, et cetera. So a quick example, in us trying to help a patient access a treatment program who was experiencing active withdrawal in our office building, an insurance company would not authorize their entry into a detoxification program until they hit a certain medical threshold. So we literally had to keep a sick patient under our supervision until this was before our medical clinic opened. So at any point, this person could have experienced overdose had they walked away and used. And they were certainly in agony, but there was a nurse on site taking a blood pressure and reading some other vital signs from this patient every single hour for about 7 hours until finally the insurance company said, yes, you can send this patient into detox now. So that's just an example of what one person had to go through. And that's one person out of 2,000 that we see. So,
if I could just take a moment, too, to touch on the other issue that you brought up, is that now, as the case or whatever, that people are now paying attention because it has broadened into many different sectors of the population, and it's an important fact that I don't think we should overlook. And the truth is that addiction, we've been incarcerating people, particularly people of color, for what is really a health issue and a mental health issue for years, and that at the root of much of that is trauma. And there's some very interesting research going on here in the city of Syracuse, mapping traumatic stress in the city and looking at how that correlates not only to poor academic functioning but to traumatic stress and substance use, be it alcohol or something else. So our eyes are being opened, maybe socially more broadly, but this is something that that society's been suffering it for with. It's just now, perhaps people are paying attention differently.
I have a comment and a statement. First, for Mark, I volunteer at a place for single moms, and many of them utilize the center at Kraus and get their doses. And I hear about how they're treated. The impact on their lives. What a fantastic program. You've saved many lives, and many young babies have benefited from this. So I wanted to make that comment. But for Aaron, quite frankly, I'm not educated really on the syringe program, mm-hmm. and what I have heard about it is not always positive, and I wanted to just put out there so you could respond to everyone and educate me. But I've heard that this program is primarily in our more poor neighborhoods in the city with regard to this truck or mobile syringe truck, and that children in these poor communities find these used syringes, you know, on their streets, and that many of the users come from the suburbs in to get their their syringe and then go back to the suburbs where this truck or trucks could not even be parked because many of those communities would not allow it. So I hear these things, and I think it's important to tell people exactly how that works.
I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. Thank you so much. So first, Syringe Exchange is a public health program. And as I alluded to earlier in my introduction, we have a goal of helping people access treatment as well as many other services, insurance programs, medical programs, mental health, domestic violence, et cetera. It really does not, it's not limited to just their addiction. The objective of Syringe Exchange is to interrupt the transmission cycle of communicable diseases. So by giving people who are actively using drugs, specifically those drugs that are injected, access to clean, sterile equipment, along with education about how to correctly use that equipment, because there is a correct injection technique that will limit further health problems like abscesses. You can prevent the spread of HIV, hepatitis C, syphilis, and other diseases. What this means for the community is that you have overall a healthier community, and that you as a community member are less likely to come into contact with HIV and hepatitis, and certainly hepatitis. That's a very strong virus that can stay alive on a needle, for example, that's been discarded in the street for up to 6 weeks. HIV does not work in the same way. So in terms of how the program in New York State works, Syringe Exchange allows anyone who discloses that they're injecting drugs to come into a program and enroll anonymously. We actually enroll people confidentially, which means I can't tell you who our clients are, but I can tell you that we have 2,200 clients. They do a brief screening with us that discloses the amount of drugs that they use, how they use. Specifically, they describe their techniques. They tell us where they're using. We help them identify veins that are better. We teach them how to rotate veins so that they're not always using the same vein, again, leading to these other health problems. We educate them that they want to use not only a new needle, but a new set of works every time they prepare their materials, because hepatitis C specifically can also be transferred in the waters and the filters, the spoons that people use to mix their heroin specifically. So all of this education leads to the user understanding that their materials that they use to inject are theirs alone, and the program gives them those materials for their use. We encourage them to bring their needles back to us. New York State does not require it to be a one-for-one exchange. We're actually not allowed to do that, which means that if I give you 10 needles, I am not making you bring 10 back to me in order to get your next 10. And that's a state regulation. We have an amazingly positive return rate for the amount of syringes that we distribute. So for the argument that there's needle litter in a community because there's a syringe exchange, that's actually counterproductive, because we're one of the only people who's accepting needle litter. There's very few kiosks available or like drop boxes for needle litter. And I would say if you're finding needle litter in a community, it's because there's rampant drug use in a community, not because there's a syringe exchange program operating. We do have political pressures in terms of where we are and aren't allowed to operate. But the people that are coming to our mobile health unit, which is on the Near West Side, those people they live within a mile of where that mobile health unit is parked. The people that come to that particular location are not driving from Cicero, Camillus, et cetera. We have an office that operates at West Genesee Street, and it's actually much more comfortable for, let's say, suburban populations to visit our office versus driving to the west side to visit the mobile health unit. So those are a couple of great questions.
If I could add to that also, I would say 2 years ago, I live in Manlius, a nice suburb. I began finding discarded needles near alongside Troop K Road and near the golf course or whatever. So it's everywhere. Yeah. So the aspect is that the fact that there are that it's concentrated, and that politically we will only permit that to be in certain neighborhoods where people may have less agency to say something about it, doesn't mean it's not happening in other places. So I would like to see us have collection sites at pharmacies and in bathrooms and other places so people could dispose of things. Do we wish that we didn't need it? Absolutely. But the reality is what it is or whatever. And so we need to recognize.
The good news if I could interject quickly, the good news is, I should tell you, it hasn't totally been rolled out yet, but Onondaga County Department of Health, Syracuse Police, there are going to be additional collection sites. So there are going to be collection sites for both drugs as well as for needle exchange. And that's a huge program, and we're looking forward to that being rolled out shortly.
This is more of a quasi-statement, but looking at this through a different prism, the healthcare costs and hospital admissions, the program, Aaron, that you've talked about, that you've all talked about, of being able to provide medical care to people who come in with now, who can come in safely with addiction issues, have a major impact on healthcare costs. And I just wanted to spin it up so people realize that this is all the result of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, affectionately or non-affectionately. But because of the Affordable Care Act, they are able to give money to hospitals, to the state, who's doing a wonderful job through their health department, their mental health department, of people who have both mental health issues and addiction issues, to be able to get that medical care because now they feel free to come in. And it has a direct impact on the taxpayer. And I think too often people don't realize the real benefits of the Affordable Care Act. And here it is in a live, tangible working environment.
That's an excellent point, because in the absence of that, it's estimated that if there's $120 billion in unnecessary medical costs related to misdiagnosis of mental health and substance use disorders, misplaced, inaccurately addressed treatment and provision of services. And so we are otherwise paying for it. So I'm glad to hear you say that you see the benefits of that as well, because we're starting to turn the tide a little bit.
Recently, I was at another forum in Auburn, and the issue came up as the frustration of police officers and some of the ER people is the issue of a 72-hour hold. And there was a good discussion of pros and cons, and I'm wondering what you're thinking of the fact that, you know, somebody is there and they want to hold them for at least 72 hours to try to entice them into some form of a treatment. What is your feelings on that?
I have a little. Similar, there's pros and cons. You know, we've had people that have gone into emergency departments, they've overdosed, or they've overdosed, been Narcaned, brought to EDs, leave EDs, overdose again, die. Why wouldn't families want people to hold them? But then there's rights. People have rights. Is this okay to hold people? Also, if you hold somebody for 72 hours and their tolerance starts to go down and they leave and they're still not connected with treatment, are you putting them in more danger of a risk of overdose for when they use after 72 hours of abstinence? And it's an extremely complicated question. I do hope that if they're going to implement a 72-hour holding, that we have lots of options of treatment so that somebody can go from the hold right to a continuation of treatment so that when they leave, you know, they have a better chance of success. We also have to think about how holding them for 72 hours may impact their life. There's a lot of people that don't want people to have the right to hold us for 72 hours over the drug use. I'm not saying we should or shouldn't, but there's a lot of different thoughts on that. So those are my thoughts on it.
We're dealing with a very functional group of users in a lot of situations. So these are people with jobs, careers. We see teachers, lawyers, nurses. I mean, these are not what you might characterize as heroin users or addicts. That's a very common word that's used to describe them. They have children. And I think that 72-hour holds specifically create these other social challenges in their lives where jobs do become in jeopardy. What happens if it's a single parent? Who's going to take care of those kids? And now that those children have an experience of trauma, of dealing within like the child welfare system, if there's even a place for them in that system. So I think we do have to think about all of the aspects of that person and whether it's most beneficial. And if we can encourage them versus forcing them to stay, that's probably a little bit softer, but maybe more thoughtful approach in the long run.
Thank you to our panel.
Thank you.
And thank also my wonderful moderator who was able to join us today. Also, thank you all for coming, but I want to say especially thank you to the nursing students that are here from upstate. Thank you for coming.